Hear argument now in NLRB against Perwood.
May it please the court. The respondent, Kerwood Incorporated, was found to have violated Section 81 of the National Labor Relations Act by announcing and promising improvement in pension benefits, and secondly, blaming the union for the absence of further benefits. That's at short appendix of 6. Factually, there is no controversy in this case. On April 7th of 2000, the respondent promised improved pension benefits to its employees.
Mr. Kinney, one of the points about that letter that you did not, shall we say, emphasize in your brief is the fact that the first sentence said, "We are aware that union authorization cards are being circulated at the plant," and that indeed the testimony showed that this letter was written with the union's organizational campaign very much in mind.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think the record actually reflects the fact that we were probably aware of the union's organizing efforts in March. So actually,
right,
even
and
before
so that's
the letter.
Why you sent the letter. So this letter was not just some random notification that you were thinking about the health care and pension plans. This letter was given particularly with no specific information about what these improvements were going to be or anything beyond late spring and early summer for an announcement. It's a very vague letter.
I would agree with that. I mean, clearly we were aware of the organizing, and we were also clearly announcing that there was going to be a change in the pension.
Right. So this is not a, I mean, the thing that bothered me is it's a letter designed to tell the employees, don't go with the union because we're going to fix this problem that's been a beef of yours.
Well, I would think that was probably one of the hopes. Yes, I have to acknowledge that.
And you would agree that that letter would have been unlawful if the company had distributed it after the petition had been filed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But coercion occur outside the critical period? In other words, looking at that April 7th letter, it has to be viewed in the context of everything that was going on, doesn't it?
See, that's actually the reason that it can't be. Supreme Court said in Exchange Parts that promise of benefits that occur inside the critical period after a petition has filed are illegal. That violates Section 8A1 of the Act. Everything is based on the Section 7 rights of employees. Employees have the right to form, join, and assist, or refrain from form, joining, or assisting. It's that protected, concerted action.
Section 7 doesn't make anything turn on when the representation petition is filed.
That's
unions,
that
employees have those rights at all times.
At all times.
QED, one would think.
What, excuse me?
QED, one would think. Nothing turns on the date on which the representation petition is filed.
Other than the fact that a Section 8A1 violation for a promise of benefit, according to the Supreme Court in NLRB versus Exchange Parts, the critical date, the bright line, is always going to be the filing of the petition.
No, but that's how the court
says.
What
the court says. Not remotely what the court says.
I think they say it twice, actually, in the
decision. No. They say it's illegal after, but they're not making any comment about what you can do. You can't just squash Section 7 rights the day before the petition is filed with impunity. Nothing in Exchange Part says that.
Section 7 rights of employees are the right to engage in or refrain from protected concerted activities. When employers give wage increases or take away wage increases or change benefits for employees, they are always going to be impinging on Section 7 rights.
No, but you didn't only do that. You didn't only say, we're going to give you a better pension at some point in the future or later this summer, whatever. You said, don't sign the union authorization cards. You know, this is because of the union organizing campaign. That is a different letter. I mean, this is a field, as you well know, filled with fine distinctions, and that one, that one is an important distinction.
And that's why, I keep going back to, there has to be a line. We were just heard in the previous case, there's got to be a line. And the line that has to be drawn, because employees will, if two employees come forward and say, Mr. Employer, we would like a wage increase, okay, that's protected concerted activities. If the employer doesn't like those employees concerting.
Well, let me ask you whether there's someplace else in labor law where the NLRB draws a line at the filing of the representation petition. Suppose that while the cards are being circulated, the employer sends out a cameraman to take pictures of anybody signing an authorization card. Is that okay under Section 7? I think the answer is pretty plainly no.
Yeah.
And that's because what matters is that the organization campaign was going on. You wouldn't think that, gee, until the formal representation petition is signed, the employer can go around and take pictures or make threats or whatever. Well, the problem is that exchange parts viewed these kinds of communications as implied threats. And if you adopt the general principle that the employer can't make threats any time during the during the organization campaign, there we are, right?
But, the threat, it falls under Section 8A3 of the Act. This is an 8A1 violation. And remember, an 8A1 violation, it is the simple fact of the Act.
Let me come back to my question. If you look at 8A1,
right.
Where is the set of cases that courts or the NLRB have said you are allowed to do X before the representation petition is filed and forbidden to do X after the representation petition is filed?
Well, the only thing
set of cases.
The only thing I would point out is that, and I don't know of a set of cases, but I do know the fact that
I know of a technical term for it. It's called a null set.
I am not aware of a case that says that.
And in exchange parts and with WISPAC that you rely on, the court didn't even address the issue there of an alleged promise of benefits before a petition was filed. True?
That is correct.
And even in language in WISPAC, the court said the board may on occasion, however, take into account actions occurring outside the critical period to the extent that they add meaning or context to the days and weeks leading up to the election.
Right. And the
and you don't have any authority that's contrary to that conclusion.
No, as a matter of fact, I agree with that. But the difference here, Your Honor, is that while the court, as you said in WISPAC, while the court may certainly take into consideration the events leading up to, what happens here, though, is the violation actually occurs on April 7th. They're not taking into consideration. They're actually basing a finding of a violation on it.
But then if we read it that way, then if we forbid consideration of those activities, especially when an employer later makes announcements during a critical period, isn't that counter to the policy behind the NLRA?
If an employer cannot make a policy change during the critical period, that is the law of exchange parts. Prior to exchange parts, prior to the filing of a petition, there is no prohibition against an employer changing its wages, hours, terms, conditions of employment. That's the struggle with this case, because exchange parts does say...
Your real problem is that you don't agree with exchange parts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I actually do.
You do?
Yes.
Because I don't. I think it's a stupid decision.
It may
if I were you, I would be arguing against it and trying to set up a case where I would bet there's a decent chance the Supreme Court would overrule it. But no, if you agree with exchange parts, that's fine. Now, let me ask you a question about this case. What is it you want of us?
To deny...
I wonder whether we even have an Article 3 case or controversy here, because so far as I can figure out, the Labor Board's order doesn't require you to do anything. It's not a bargaining order. It doesn't require you to recognize the union. It doesn't require you to rescind any of the benefits increases. It doesn't require you to equate the benefits of the maintenance workers with the benefits in the defined unit. It seems to have no effect whatsoever.
It does require us to post a notice and admit that we were guilty of violating
yeah,
the law.
On that rationale, you could get an advisory opinion from a court, provided that at the end the advisory opinion had to be posted on a bulletin board. That's never been my understanding of Article 3. This is the first case I've ever seen in labor law where there was nothing except the notice.
There is a rerun election.
Yep, that's a separate order which you have not challenged. And it's also the case that the union didn't need the board's order to get it. So there's nothing here, so far as I can see, except the notice. No back pay, no reinstatement,
that
no
is correct.
Nothing. Is there any case you know of that says that it is within the court's Article 3 power to adjudicate a labor dispute where there is nothing at issue except posting a notice?
I believe that the posting of the notice is the most traditional form of an NLRB remedy.
The NLRB always orders it. But as I say, every NLRB case I have ever seen in my life or that I ever recall reading in any reports involves something else as well, like back pay or reinstatement or bargaining or...
But you'd never have it, Your Honor, you'd never have an 8A1 case with anything more than a order posting with the notice and the admission. The only time you're going to get back pay reinstatement is going to be if you're going to have an 883 violation, perhaps if you've got an 885 violation.
Obvious you haven't thought about this. I think it would be a good idea if the parties were to file memos within 10 days addressing the question whether it is within our powers under Article 3 of the Constitution to enforce, not enforce, or say anything about a labor board order that entails no remedy whatsoever other than posting a notice.
I have not thought
about it. Because, as I say, the problem otherwise would be then we could issue advisory opinions of every sort, provided only that they were posted someplace after we issued them. Well, you know, we send them to the Federal Reporter. So, in a sense, we post all our opinions. Posting can't be the thing that makes it okay to issue advisory opinion.
The only thing I would add is that the posting does go to the employees. That's the only official notice the employees would receive as to whether or not the law had been violated. I guess I'm making the NLRB's argument.
If you came to us and said, we would like an advisory opinion on the question whether we can make the following benefits offer, and after you issue your advisory opinion, we'll tell our employees, would the fact we'll tell our employees what you've said mean that we could issue this advisory opinion?
Probably not.
One would think not, but that's what raises the question here, right?
The only thing I would think...
What we're being asked for is raw legal views that have no consequences in the world except that the employees will be told what our legal views are.
To a certain extent, I think that's correct. Other than, again, the theory...
Because the notice, of course, changes as soon as this court...
Right.
Said something, the notice doesn't say the NLRB wants you to do
right.
this. It says
the Court of Appeals
wants you to do this.
Court of Appeals says these are your rights.
Yeah.
Like I said, Your Honor, the NLRB brought this case on
David,
enforcement. And,
ten days for the parties to address the question whether we are not being asked for an advisory opinion.
Would you like me to continue?
Well,
you're in your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry.
You can do as you wish.
Okay. I will hold some of my rebuttal then.
Okay. Mr. Plitz.
Hey, please the court. My name is Dan Blitz. I represent the board petitioner in this case. I'll speak for 10 minutes, then intervener's counsel will take 5.
And Mr. Blitz, just to clarify, this representation proceeding that's not before us is chugging along somehow?
It's currently, my understanding is it's being held in abeyance with the regent. Obviously, that portion is not
pending
a final...
Pending the resolution of this case? Or just to hold it in abeyance?
Pending the resolution.
We were talking the whole case.
Yeah, correct. Pending the resolution of this.
Okay.
With respect to the exchange parts argument, I think there's a simple answer to that. The company did not raise this argument in its exception to the board, so it's simply barred from raising it before this court at this time. overwhelming evidence supports the board's findings in this case. This is simply a case in which a company learned about employees' union activities. It knew that those activities were centered on improving pension benefits. It set out to blunt the union campaign by hastily cobbling together an unprecedented benefit and manipulating the timing of its announcements in violation of 8A1.
Since time is limited, let me ask you about the one part of the board's order that concerns me on the merits, if we are allowed by the Constitution to reach them. And that's the board's conclusion that it was an unfair labor practice to put the maintenance workers within the BRP, right, the apparently better pension plan, and provide transition relief for 12 of them. And I understand your argument under exchange parts, but the board's position with respect to the maintenance workers seems to be that if Unit A is being organized, then the employer can't make any changes for anyone else at the plant. And that's not provided by exchange parts, or so far as I know, by any other decision. The board's brief cites none. And it seems to me quite a radical proposition that if you attempt to organize Group A of workers, the employer is in stasis for all of its workers.
That would be a novel position. That is not what happened here, however. This is merely a cease and desist order requiring the company to cease from cease and desist from announcing that benefit, the grant of that benefit.
Well, it makes no sense to say that the employer can put the maintenance workers in the BRP. It just can't tell them.
The message we're arguing is that it was implicitly delivered to the production employees.
Yeah, but you could make that argument for any other worker of any other benefit of Kerwood, Inc. as a whole. It's likely, you know, it's these workers, the people in the unit the board has defined, are likely to learn that somebody else got a raise or a parking space or a pension.
Likely to learn in the normal course of events is one thing.
Yeah.
Learning from a company's actions, manipulative actions, is another thing. That's
right, and that's explained in the opinion, but then if you go to the actual order, mm-hmm. which is what the company will have to comply with, it just says cease and desist from announcing and promising improvements in pension or other benefits in order to discourage union support. It doesn't say anything about, you know, under the circumstances where the production workers are getting the implicit message that only if they vote against the union. I realize that I'm talking about a long phrase, but it's just worded very broadly in a way that makes it look like they couldn't do anything with the maintenance workers either. That's
right. Yeah. If what the board had wanted to do was say, you can give the maintenance workers anything they want, provided you haven't committed an unfair labor practice by jiggering the benefits of the workers in the defined union unit, that would be one thing. But the actual order says you just can't give the maintenance workers, or implicitly anybody else, if you know that may come back or be learned by the unit workers.
I respectfully disagree. I think the order is a reasonable reading of the order limits it to the facts at issue in this case, and it's implicit in the order that the benefit that
I don't understand. The order purports to speak to the future.
That's
it
correct.
Says we will not. It's talking about the future. The future is not limited to the facts of this case. There's a whole difference between the future and the past.
Yeah. In order to discourage union support, it's not the mere announcement of that benefit. It's to get them to stop from manipulating it in that way. That's what was at issue here.
So the bottom line is you don't have any authority that giving benefits to non-union employees during a critical period is improper. That's the bottom line.
You
don't have any cases.
Any other case in the history of the board,
no other
litigation. Your brief cites none.
With respect to the July 13th.
No, not with respect to this July 13th. With respect to any case in the history of the National Labor Relations Board, which has been around for a long time, mm-hmm. in which when Unit A of workers is being organized, the board said that there could be no benefit changes or improvements in Unit B, that a benefit change or improvement in Unit B was an unfair labor practice. Any case in the history of the board?
You're correct. They're none cited in this brief.
Your problem is that you're claiming that you're not even trying to do that here, and yet the language certainly could be read, maybe even should be read that way. So that's I think the problem the board faces. Maybe kind of everybody knew, quote unquote, what they meant, but later on when this thing is posted, maybe everybody won't know what that means, and it can't be worded that way.
Or when we issue our advisory opinion, enforcing it.
Right. With respect to that point,
maybe we should write a different advisory opinion than the board did.
The question was raised earlier about cases involving only cease and desist orders. I would submit it's a fairly common occurrence, such as 8A1 interrogation cease and desist orders. It's not something novel. Not every case before the board involves back pay, reinstatement, things
of that
nature.
Could you see these as in the nature of affirmative injunctions or negative injunctions or something punitive? I mean, the company is also forbidden to blame the union for the absence of further benefits.
That was a separate unfair labor practice
right.
allegation, so that
right.
within this order.
But you see this, the cease and desist orders provisions, is being the nature of behavior regulation for the future of some kind?
The board's order applies prospectively, that's correct. The affirmative part here, as was mentioned, is the posting of the notice. This is a routine order. The board gives cease and desist orders routinely. And
right, but then the notice says we will not do certain things, typically. I mean,
are we being asked to enforce an underlying cease and desist order?
Correct. Cease and desist orders is directly within the board's statutory authority.
Asking the question, are we being asked to enforce a particular cease and desist order? I'm now trying to get the board.
Correct.
You keep saying correct.
Yeah, the order here.
Well, the order that's at page 5 of the appendix in Kerwood's brief is the one that's appended to the actual board opinion, not the ALJ's opinion, so it reflects the modification. Orders that respondent shall take the action set forth in the order is modified, and then we get the two, you know.
That's because the board reversed some of the judges.
Right, I know that's why and how it got there, but you have to kind of go back and put it together, because paragraph 1 of the ALJ's order over on page 16 begins with 1, period, cease and desist from, and then I guess you plug in the A and B.
In your post-argument memos, one thing that would help us is, I think, to give us the full final order of the board that we're being asked to enforce, plugging in those changes so that we can see what concretely is actually at issue. Because the ALJ's got some cease and desist language that maybe if you plug in what the board has done, looks more injunction-like.
And going back to this non-unit point, if we disagree with the board on that particular finding, do we have to remand the case? What would your view be?
You disagree with the board on the July 13th allegation? No, because the representation case is not before the court at this time. Not a final order.
Well, I think my colleague's question had to do with what if we disagree with the board about the grant of pension benefits to the maintenance workers? That's not the representational action.
Sorry, I misunderstood. Yes, that's correct. That independent 8A1 allegation violation finding could be remanded to the board for further explanation or the like. To sum up, I think it's a fairly clear case, a routine order, and the board respectfully submits that the order.
The routine order is just something the board has never done in its entire history, which is now more than 60 years.
I'm
closing in on
sorry with that. Well, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Allison.
Good morning. My name is Tom Allison. I represent the union intervening petitioner. Let me just address two of these issues. With respect to the cease and desist order, the board, when you're going to put it all together, the board has entered a traditional 8A1 remedy of requiring the company to cease and desist from this activity found illegal and to post the notice. This is a traditional 8A1 order. In 8A3 cases where people are terminated, you get back pay and reinstatement. In 8A5 cases where you have bargaining in bad faith, you'll get an order to bargain. In 8A1 cases, there's frequently just activity that has no monetary or bargaining consequences, and this is the traditional order. My guess is if you go back to exchange parts itself and read the underlying board order, you will find that it was simply a cease and desist from providing benefits of this type. And also this order now becomes enforceable by contempt powers once we hope this Court of Appeals enters an order enforcing it. So it's not simply an advisory opinion we're talking about. We're talking about an order directing the company to cease and desist from certain things that is now going, I hope, to become enforceable. With respect to the maintenance employees, the facts of this case are that the board found, the company granted this increase to the maintenance employees knowing that it would anger the production employees who were about to vote. They announced that change 1 week before the election, even though it's not going to take place until over 6 months after the election.
But the focus can't be on the benefit given to the maintenance employees per se. I mean,
no,
it has
not
to be on the manipulative message being sent to the production employees.
And that's the contrast between the benefit to the maintenance employees and the peculiar letters sent to the production employees.
And that's exactly what the board focuses in, both in the judge's discussion and in the framing of the order. The board orders them not to make these changes, these benefit improvements, in order to discourage union support.
Yeah, but the problem is not only does that not mean anything standing by itself, there's an awful lot of language in the ALJ's and the board's opinion which suggests the board views granting benefits to any other worker as discouraging union support.
No, I don't believe so. They focused on the fact that they took the announcement.
We shouldn't have to psychoanalyze them. This ought to be written down, right, in the remedy.
The remedy is limited to only those occasions when it's done in order to discourage union support. It doesn't limit.
That's the same language as used in exchange parts, and that's what leads to my query, which is the board saying that under exchange parts, once Unit A is being organized, there can be no benefits changes anywhere else in the employer?
No.
Because the board's view now is that exchange parts applies to everybody else too.
No, that's not what the board is saying. The board is saying that the company is limited in making these changes only to those occasions when they do it in order to discourage union support.
But that's the exchange parts doctrine. The employer can change the benefits of the people in the unit being organized unless it does it for that purpose.
Right. And it can't change benefits outside of that unit in order to interfere with employees' Section 7 rights. It's a very limiting condition.
Is it the change of the benefits, though, or is it the way that it was communicated? Suppose the employer, you know, under strict confidentiality protections, had whispered in the ear of each of the maintenance employees, "You're going to get a better pension." And had said, "And if you say a word about this, you're fired," just like, you know, you're a software programmer or something.
Surely
there has to be some way they could deal, as they had done in the past, in fact, with letters to the home.
If the company had done that, that would have been strong evidence that they did not do it in order to discourage union support. If they had done it, announced it a week later after the election, it would have been obvious it was not done to discourage union support. If they hadn't photocopied the letter and put it on
every... the election, they could have done the same thing for the people in the unit because the union lost the election.
There was no reason...
That's what I'm looking for, a distinction between the people in the unit being organized and the people outside of it.
The company cannot act generally to discourage... for the purpose of discouraging union support, discourage the exercise of Section 7 rights.
So that you're saying even, you know, vis-a-vis its management, vis-a-vis anybody,
it cannot fire a supervisor. It cannot fire a supervisor who is not protected and is not
so
an employee under the
act. The supervisor is a union cheerleader and they decide to fire him.
They cannot fire him for the purpose of discouraging union support.
It has to be a common problem. The electricians' union is... you know, engaged in collective bargaining, and the welders are not organized. right?
Okay.
Any benefit that's given to the welders is sure to get back to the electricians. There's no way you can stop the people from talking. So as I understand your position, if while the electricians are engaged in bargaining or organizing or anything like that, the welders get a benefits increase, if we don't have a for sure unfair labor practice, we have a litigating position where the labor board is pretty much free to find what it wants. Because the labor board will say the electricians learned, were bound to learn what happened to the welders, and this was a very discouraging event to them.
That's not what the board found. The board found in this case, and I don't think that would be an unfair labor practice, the board found in this case that the company did a variety of things for the specific intention of discouraging union support, all related to this increase to the maintenance employees. They took the letter announcing it to the maintenance employees, they taped it on every production employee's desk, and they highlighted it
Look, that's not what the facts show. You say they. There's no evidence in this record that the employer did that.
The evidence
in this record is that some of the maintenance workers did that.
No, there's no evidence of that. The evidence is that the findings are, it showed up on everybody's desk in the production department. The company never took it down, and the board found that it was distributed with the intention that the production employees would find it. That was the finding.
I just can't imagine a rule under the Labor Act that says benefits increases may be granted to your other workers only if they take the CIA's oath of secrecy and they're fired if they tell their coworkers what just happened.
That's not what they say, Your Honor. And maybe Your Honor would like us to brief in addition within 10 days the issue of whether there is any other board cases that
This is not a new issue. This is a subject that was or should have been covered by the existing brief. So no, we will not
have separate, thank you, Your
separate
Honor.
Briefs on that. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Kinney?
Only this. Again, I want to go back to exchange parts for the simple reason that it is critical to note that the Supreme Court does draw a distinction between pre-petition and post-petition conduct and only condemns.
Where does the Supreme Court draw the distinction? To say all A is improper is not to say that not A is not improper. Right, that's just a logical non sequitur. We have a case in which there is, say, probable cause to believe that there's cocaine in the car when the defendant is stopped. And the Supreme Court says you can search on probable cause. That does not imply if no probable cause, you cannot search. Right? It just says if probable cause, you can search. Well, you got the same thing here. The facts of exchange parts are that the activity occurred after. That does not imply that this is the only thing that can violate the National Labor Relations Act. It's just a logical error.
But exchange parts does talk about only post-petition conduct. And so when the administrative law judge...
But that's all the conduct there was in exchange parts.
And that is the authority that is now being relied on by the NLRB when, if in fact the only conduct in exchange parts is post-petition, okay? And if that is the authority that is being relied on by the NLRB, then it's wrong. Then they picked the wrong case.
The National Labor Relations Board is relying on the Wagner Act. It is not relying on exchange parts. Exchange parts held that the Labor Board had the discretion in interpreting the statute to come up with this rule. There's nothing in exchange parts that cabined the Labor Board's discretion that rewrote the statute or anything else. Right. This case does not rest on exchange parts. It rests on a federal statute interpreted by a federal agency.
Right. And the reason that you run into the problem with it is because Section 7 rights of employees exist at all times, and that becomes the conundrum. You never get around the conundrum that grants or takeaways will always impact an employee's desire to organize or not organize.
That's why I should think your logical argument would have been with exchange parts. There we go.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This case is taken under advisement.